My name is Maureen Ayers-Luby. I am an obstetrician gynecologist from Minneapolis, Minnesota. So that means that I deliver babies, I see women in clinic for general health maintenance, I also do pelvic surgery. And so I got kind of looped into Holden. I came for the first time last summer, got to do a little bit about women's health stuff at that time, and now here again. My husband is Matthew Olson, the village musician, so I luckily get to come along and do a little bit of a very different than a lot of the theological seminars that you guys get. So that being said, I'm not a professor or a preacher, so I'm not super good in front of large groups. So I'm just going to pretend you're all my patients. I'm just talking to you, and then I'll be comfortable. And hopefully you guys feel like you can ask questions, make this interactive as much or as little as you guys would like. So for the first hour today, we're going to be talking mostly focusing on young women's health. So primarily, I'm just going to be talking through some things that might seem like very like, oh yeah, duh, basic stuff, but I still feel like there are so many misconceptions about, and sometimes it's just helpful to kind of go back through. So this is kind of a general outline of what I'll be chatting about today. And also, slight disclaimer, I've tried to make it as easy and approachable as possible, but if I start using words that aren't familiar to people, please just raise your hand and I will define things or whatnot for everybody. The stuff that you've heard about, seventh grade health class, right? Female reproductive organs. So we start with talking about the womb, right? The kind of a common word that people have called the uterus. The uterus is kind of the more medical term for it. The uterus itself is a hollow muscular structure, which is the where period blood forms and also what houses a pregnancy. The ovaries are these two whitish glands on either side of the uterus. They have a couple of functions. Number one, they secrete female hormones into your bloodstream, and they also hold all of the female's eggs. They additionally have the job of making one egg mature and be released every month, but we're going to get to that in a little bit. The fallopian tube are these little tubes that, literally a tube made of smooth muscle that extend out from either side of the uterus out to the ovaries. The job of a fallopian tube is to catch the eggs as they kind of are extruded from the ovary and sweep them up and bring them down into the uterus to implant. The cervix at the bottom of the uterus there is the name given to this just the bottom part of the uterus muscle. It literally means neck. The word cervix means neck. You might have heard of cervical spine being like the spine that are in your neck. So the cervix is a really strong muscular tube, which is the passageway from the top of a vagina into the uterus. For most of a pregnancy, it's closed, and then during labor, it opens to allow the baby to pass through. But again, that's another topic. You'll notice, as we are kind of looking at and defining some of the female anatomy, that a lot of female anatomy of the reproductive system is defined by its function in pregnancy. So hence being called, this is the female reproductive system. The vagina at the bottom is a term that a lot of people, especially in lay culture, use to mean the entire reproductive system. But the vagina itself is really just a layer of skin that forms a tube between the outside world and the cervix, or the opening to the uterus. The vagina is the last place that a baby passes through when it's delivered to the outside. It's also where a tampon sits or where a penis goes during sex, which is probably why it's used as the partner for male sex organs. Though, as I will show you momentarily, the female body part, which is actually most similar to the penis in structure and function, is a different organ, the clitoris. I also have a pelvic floor model here to show basic anatomy in three dimensions, and you can see in this picture here, which is this is a picture taken during a surgery where we put a scope or a camera in right at the belly button, and then this is looking from above. So this is the uterus. These are the ovaries, the little whitish glands. You can kind of see this is a fallopian tube here and then here. And then these are all just kind of suspensory ligaments inside the body. And you can't really see it, but the bladder is kind of on the front side there. So that's kind of the real life picture. But what about the outside parts, right? So, the outside. As I briefly mentioned, the the clitoris is a female sexual organ, but doesn't play any anatomic role in reproduction. So it gets overlooked a lot in your actual 7th grade health class. The clitoris is an organ located at the front part of the opening to the vagina, but only a really small part of it shows on the outside of the body. It's actually a larger organ underneath that kind of forms a wishbone structure. It has a lot of nerve endings, is super sensitive, and is anatomically similar to the male penis. And kind of, you know, going back to embryology, when, you know, a fetus is going to differentiate and be either a female or a male, these come from all the same organs that would develop into a penis in a male. The main function of the clitoris is sexual pleasure and orgasm in the female. And since this can be a taboo topic in a lot of cultures, a lot of young women don't really know much about it. And additionally, you know, it's a little off topic for this lecture, but we do have a discussion segment later if you want to come and talk about that and keep that in mind. But then continuing to look through at more anatomy, the urethra is the opening just under the clitoris. It's still at the top of the vaginal opening where the pee comes out. The urethra is a tube that's directly connected to the bladder, which lies in front of the uterus on the inside. The labia minora and the labia majora make up the skin folds of the vagina. Minora meaning little and majora meaning big. The distinction between these two is that there's hair that grows on the labia majora but not on the labia minora. And the entire area that I've just talked to you about is the external female, I'm going to say it, genitalia. Nobody's favorite word, but there it is, it's out there. This whole external female genitalia can be referred to as the vulva. The perineum at the bottom, you can see it kind of sort of points to, is this whole skin bridge, kind of between the vagina and the anus. And the perineum is it's a special structure, or it gets talked about, because it can tear during the birth of a baby. And you know, that's typically the spot that's the weakest, or, you know, it's kind of like stretching a rubber band just too far, and that's the part that tends to tear. So if you've got friends who have recently or are going to have a baby, this is probably something that they have some thoughts about, and maybe you have too at one point in your life. And then at the bottom, the anus is obviously where poop comes out. This second photo here is slightly more realistic version. I think the cartoon helps a little bit just to understand where things are, but I like then the less cartoonish version where you can see more of the body of the clitoris on the top there, kind of showing in white, and you can also appreciate some of the pelvic, the muscles of the pelvic floor. So, if that was all old news and you're just like falling asleep in here, don't get too bored, because next we're going to talk about hormone cycles, which I find that even though I've gone through pre-med, medical school, and an OBGYN residency, every time I go back and learn about this, I'm like, oh gosh, yes, that learn something new every time. This makes sense all over again. So yeah, if you have any questions as we are going through this, feel free to raise your hand. This is a poster from iHeartGuts, which is an awesome website if you've never visited. They have little anatomical models of every single organ in the body. But I really like this because it kind of shows a little bit in a more pictorial way to maybe kind of remember. So the hormone cycle takes about 28 days in the typical average female. We arbitrarily label the first day of the period as the first day of the cycle because there's an outward sign of the beginning of this phase. So it's easy to say day one. Even though this is the part that people think about the most, it's actually not that interesting hormone-wise. The two female hormones, estrogen and progesterone, generally at the beginning of the cycle are pretty low, and people's symptoms are, you know, cramping, bleeding, and they're occupied with other things. But so cycle day one, first day of bleeding. Then, as things kind of get ramped up toward day six, this part, it's kind of interesting because the early part of the cycle is all about the brain. The little red guy here, the hypothalamus, is a structure in the brain. It turns on and cranks out a hormone called GnRH, which you can see here coming out of the blue GnRH spout. Luckily, the name of the hormone, gonadotropin-releasing hormone, or GnRH, that little lightish blue guy, tells us exactly what it does. It releases gonadotropins. gonad for ovaries or testicles in males, and then trophic, which means goes to. So the gonadotropins, which have two different names, and are these two different hormones down here, LH, the little orange guy, and which stands for luteinizing hormone, and then FSH, the guy, little guy in green, which stands for follicle stimulating hormone. Follicle is another word for egg. So the follicle stimulating hormone is causing the small eggs that are in the ovary to grow. So it essentially, follicle stimulating hormone starts zapping all of the eggs, and then eventually a couple start growing more dominantly than others, growing and growing until one is the most dominant follicle of all, and then that's the one that's going to ovulate. Luteinizing, or the orange guy, essentially means getting the area around the egg ready to help release the egg, and then it makes the area around the egg ready to support a pregnancy. So they have to work together. And then obviously the eggs, where these LH and FSH are targeting, are in the ovary. So this is the part where you have this first brain-to-brain signaling system, and then it makes these two hormones, which then travel down to the ovary. So now we're going into the ovary. We're on day 8. The eggs are getting stimulated and stimulated, and one grows to be the biggest, and it's the best one. It's getting ready to break out. You can see here, there's this sort of yellow padding on the outside of the egg that we, which is the part that the luteinizing hormone has made already. And it's so big, at this point you can see it on ultrasound, which is pretty cool. It's normal for them to be almost about 2 centimeters big. So this would be obviously something that if you were monitoring someone with an ultrasound, you'd be able to tell that where they're about to ovulate from. Meanwhile, as the eggs are growing, they start putting out the female hormone estrogen. That's the little peach guy in this illustration, if you remember, that the eggs are making estrogen. Question, yes.
How does it determine right ovary or left ovary?
It just, at least we think that it tends to alternate each month. So it's a matter of all of the ovaries in both, or rather all of the eggs in both ovaries are being stimulated all at one time. But once one egg is the most dominant follicle, then there's kind of a negative feedback loop that tends to just get that one. So we tend to think of it as, you know, if you have one ovary removed, then you're going to just ovulate from the same ovary every month. But we tend to think of it as one month and one the next month. So they're kind of, and they're all kind of in the same hormonal communication pathway. So even though they're located in different areas, they're kind of all the same part of the signaling system. So a week later, things are really heating up. The brain is now making the FSH and LH, which is stimulating the eggs in the ovary. The eggs in the ovary are making estrogen. Once we get to a certain level of estrogen, this triggers LH, remember the orange guy? And you can see he's located here in an arrow going up. Once we get to a certain level of estrogen, it signals LH to make a big surge up to a peak, which then in turn signals an egg, and hopefully just one, to break free from the side of the ovary, and then it leaves that little padding behind. The process of the egg breaking away from the side of the ovary is called ovulation. It's, you know, we think of it as like a person's ovulating or a process that's happening, but really ovulation is just the act of the egg breaks away. And then next, the egg travels down the fallopian tube to the uterus, and it only lives for maybe 12 to 24 hours before it dies, unless it's fertilized and becomes a pregnancy. So you can see how timing is super important in the whole process of ovulation. Next, we show the importance of the yellow padding that was left behind in the ovary. So now that comes into play. That yellow padding left behind is called the corpus luteum. And remember, the name of the luteinizing hormone was, the little orange guy was to get this all ready, that special padding. The corpus luteum's job is to make the other female hormone called progesterone, the purple guy in this illustration. So at this point, you've ovulated, FSH and LH are done. They've done their job, so they fall, the levels fall. And the progesterone level is then high during the second part of the cycle because it's being made by the corpus luteum. Then we get to day 28, which is, you know, the theoretical end of the pathway. And at this point, the egg can take one of two paths. Either It's fertilized, it becomes a pregnancy, it implants in the sidewall of the uterus, where the lining is nice and thick and ready to nourish the new pregnancy. And then the corpus luteum and the yellow padding from the egg keeps progesterone levels high to maintain the pregnancy. Or if it's not fertilized, which they kind of show on the left side here, the whole cycle has to start over again next month because you can't use the same lining. And so basically, because the if it hasn't been fertilized, then you lose the corpus luteum, which is making the progesterone. So then the progesterone falls, and it's when the progesterone falls, it's taking away that hormone that destabilizes the lining, and then you have the start of the cycle kind of all over again. Day one, period stuff. Here's another way to kind of look at the cycle, and this is, I like this graph too because it moves kind of from left to right in a day one being on the left, day 28 being on the right, progressing kind of through time. So again, you can see how the brain is pretty active at the beginning of the cycle. At the very top, they kind of even have an extra panel for it. It makes that whole brain-to-brain signaling pathway. Then it sends LH and FSH to act on the ovary, which they kind of have demonstrated coming and going down here directed to the ovary. The ovary, this middle panel, is kind of a blow-up of the ovarian wall. And you can see how one ovary or one follicle is getting bigger and bigger and bigger until finally it breaks free. On here how the level of estrogen gets higher because it's being made by this egg here. Once estrogen gets to a certain peak, then LH goes super high. Remember, that was the trigger for LH. And then when LH triggers, that triggers ovulation. And so in this illustration, you can kind of see how they're showing LH goes up on day 13 and then ovulation happens on day 14. And then after that, you can see how, and they've colored it the same color, that yellow, and it is actually in real life kind of like a yellowish color of the corpus luteum is thickening, and then that corpus luteum, it is releasing progesterone. So progesterone is this blue line here, which then goes elevated for the second half of the cycle. And then the bottom panel in this illustration is showing the thickness of the lining throughout the cycle. Remember that at the end of the cycle, it's thick to make a place for the pregnancy to implant, but then it thins out after a period to kind of start the whole thing over again. Any questions about this? This is like advanced, you're like medical school, you could go take a test. Yeah.
So how does like polycystic ovarian affect this cycle?
Yeah, so what happens in polycystic ovarian syndrome is that you don't have ovulation, and so basically you end up, it's a little bit complicated, and we can definitely talk about that a little bit more tonight, but essentially you in some cases, you have constantly high LH levels, and so you never have a triggering event, so you never ovulate, and so essentially what happens is estrogen and progesterone are kind of constantly battling who actually wants to be the higher hormone. And because estrogen thickens the lining, and progesterone, when you take it away, makes the lining get thin and bleed off. Sometimes those people have really abnormal cycles. They could be a couple of months long, or sometimes people have weird bleeding in between because the signaling of the corpus luteum, just the whole kind of signal is off. But you can think of it like a lot related to LH being high. Other questions? You're gonna get a pop quiz now.
What causes the cramping for some women?
Yeah, cramping. Cramping isn't caused by any of the female hormones. It's actually caused by an entity called, or it is a hormone, but it's called cyclooxygenase, which is the same thing. It's basically only responsible for pain. And so it's the same thing that sometimes can give people headaches, can give people cramping and other organs too. So the cramping is kind of the body's way of trying to get the bleeding to stop, because it's, you know, if you had a gash on your arm or some other muscle, you put pressure on it, right, to get it to stop bleeding. Same thing inside your uterus. Your uterus is trying to cramp and put pressure on the inside to make it stop bleeding. So, it's not actually female hormones that are causing cramping, but there are ways of stopping periods that then kind of help stop cramping, of course, because you're not having that bleeding.
Okay.
Another question over here.
Is it, I know that people take their temperature if they're trying to see when they're ovulating. Mm-hmm. Is that related to these, is your temperature related to these hormones?
Yeah, there is a thought that progesterone has to do with temperature. However, temperature tends to change right around here. So it can be a predictor, kind of, it changes kind of right with LH. And so I don't know exactly why that is, because it is thought to be more of a progesterone phenomenon. But obviously in this case, you could see that progesterone doesn't go up until after you've ovulated. So I don't have the exact physiological reason why that happens. And yeah, so some people take temperature. It's a, sometimes, generally I feel like for patients, it's a very anxiety producing way of trying to tell when you're ovulating or not. So most of the time I tell my patients not to worry about that, because it will be like 0.5 or 0.4 of a difference, and it's generally, but actually that kind of leads me to my next a pop quiz question. So, be a reproductive endocrinologist. And if you already know the answer to this, see if other people that don't know the answer can figure this out. But what would you use to predict when a person is going to ovulate? Any guesses?
LH.
LH, yeah, exactly. Good job! That's right. So it's the LH surge that you're actually looking for to detect when ovulation is going to occur. The awesome thing about LH is that we can detect it pretty easily in urine. And so we can then make these home LH kits, which makes it really easy to do. And so essentially this is what these things look like. It's kind of, it looks like a pregnancy test. You can say this is cycle day 12, there's only one line, so the control worked, but this is a negative test. Cycle day 13, negative, 14, negative, it's getting a little bit, but then cycle day 15, they clearly have two lines here. So there's a threshold which with this test will turn positive, and obviously that's really convenient for people who are either using natural family planning to not get pregnant, or who are trying to time to get pregnant. Okay, question number two. What would you use to test to confirm that someone has ovulated?
Progesterone.
Yeah, progesterone, exactly. Yes. So, great work. More budding endocrinologists over here. The unfortunate thing about progesterone is that it's a blood test. And so actually what we do is we look for, and most of the time you don't need to do this, but if we're giving you medication for ovulation, then sometimes we do, we want to prove that it actually works, because of course you could have a signal to ovulate and still your body may not ovulate. So this is kind of a way to confirm that. It's a blood test, so we just make sure we get to a certain level. And so how do birth control pills work? Generally the way that the pill works is that they keep, and this is like combined oral contraceptive pills, they keep estrogen and progesterone levels constant through the whole cycle. So estrogen over here never triggers LH, which if you don't have any LH surge, then you don't have any egg, and then no egg, no pregnancy. And then obviously, as generally people are told to take birth control pills, there's 3 weeks of active pills and then 1 week of sugar pills or placebo, which is basically you can take these just so you don't forget to take your pill every day, or you can just not take them, just take a week off. And what happens is when you then stop taking progesterone, that tells your body to have, the progesterone is causing stabilizing of the lining and thinning of the lining, but when you take it away, you're destabilizing the lining. So then you'll have that, it's a period type withdrawal bleed, but it's not quite the same as a period, because it didn't come, it's not like a failed ovulation cycle. If that makes any sense. It's a little bit different than that. But apparently they thought women really wanted periods back when they were inventing that, so they... It's so weird. It was actually, I think, the Catholic Church that decided that would be a good thing.
Why would they have anything to say about
birth? I think the person who invented it was religious.
I think he was trying to get the Catholic Church to say that it was an acceptable form of birth control.
Yeah.
Like, look how natural it is.
Look how natural it is, yeah. Yeah. So speaking of birth control, quiz time, can anybody say what these methods are? Anybody know what, how about this method?
Condoms,
yeah. How about, these are kind of hard to see. Oh, can you see what this one is?
Maneuvering,
yep. How about, these are kind of weird, but like, I'll just tell you, diaphragm, cervical cap, yeah. This one, actually this one is a diaphragm.
Female condom.
Female condom, yeah, sorry. This one, anyone? This is actually the withdrawal method. Like, you know, this is emergency birth control. This is fertility awareness or natural family planning, like we talked about. Up there's like tubes, birth control pills, the patch, the injection, spermicide, abstinence, and then these top two on the left. Yes. Awesome. Oh gosh, I got. So behind up here, just a second. Very exciting. Got off script. Okay. Well, good. So obviously there are tons of ways of preventing a pregnancy, including many hormonal methods and non-hormonal methods. So the pills, the ring, or the patch, they all use estrogen and progesterone to stop pregnancy, like we just talked about. And then condoms, fertility awareness, which is the phone, diaphragms, abstinence, the pull-out method, all of those don't use any hormones, but they're also not very reliable forms of contraception, except in most cases that don't involve Virgin Mary, abstinence is the best birth control method. There's also, of course, the top right is getting your tubes tied, which is super reliable and doesn't use any hormones, but also it's not reversible. So there's a couple of methods which in some ways have been around for hundreds of years in East Asia, but really have only gained popularity in the United States in probably the last 10 to 15 years because we now have better kind of foolproof methods for using them, and those are long-acting reversible contraception. The main two methods like this are the IUD, which is available in a 5 and 10 year version, and then the arm implant, or also known as Nexplanon, which is a 3 year device. The arm implant, which I have one here to show you, I'll pass that around. This is just like a prototype of it. It's a little matchstick shaped device we place it in the doctor's office, we just put a little bit of numbing medicine, slip it right under there, works for 3 years. The IUD is a little T-shaped device, which I'm going to pass these around to you. And this gets placed inside the uterus, and the one here is a Paragard, the copper IUD, and then these two are the Mirena and the Skyla IUDs, which the slightly smaller one is the Skyla, so you can just kind of look. And those are also prototypes of the exact thing.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What is your recommendation with lactation on some of these?
Yeah, so lactation, generally, when lactation is fully established, you can use any progesterone-containing method. I steer people away from any estrogen-containing birth control method because that can interfere with milk supply and stuff.
What about the new IUD? Is it Mirena?
Yep, the Mirena, totally fine. I love giving that to women who are lactating.
You feel like it's been around long enough to say that?
Yeah, I do. And well, maybe it's perfect timing to just all start about it right now. So the IUD, generally, the thing that I really like about the IUDs is that, many, many of the ways that we use for contraception require either if you're taking a pill, then you're swallowing it, digesting it, it goes from your stomach to your bloodstream, it goes from your bloodstream to your uterus where it does its work, right? So there's all these steps before it actually does the job it needs to do. If you're using the Nexplanon, you're bypassing at least the stomach digestion part, which is nice. That just releases progesterone into the bloodstream. The thing that I really like about the IUD, though, is that it is this little T-shaped device, goes inside the uterus, we place it at a visit in clinic, and it works. Basically, it has very, very low side effects because that little, and I think in the IUD itself, you can see there's a little kind of cart in the middle of it that is where the drug comes out of. And so it's formulated in a way that it's most highly concentrated right where it needs to be. So a very low proportion of it actually gets systemically. And so that's why you can, the Skyla has less hormone in it. So if you're more worried about kind of hormone, and you just kind of want the birth control part of it. The Skyla is also, the Skyla was originally formulated because it's smaller, and so it was formulated more for, you know, women who had never had a baby before, or who are maybe, you know, 12 or 13, like they've started having periods, but they're maybe not like full adult stature. But in any case, I think I always counsel my patients that it's totally individualized. So if you feel like you're teetering on, like maybe I don't have enough milk, maybe I'm fine, but I really don't want to do anything, then generally I would never want to jeopardize someone. Obviously the IUD is reversible though. So generally it doesn't affect people's milk supply. And
well, it's reversible, but now we have to rebound the milk supply. We would have to rebound the milk supply.
Yeah, so like I was saying, I think that it's safe. Also, I know from prior experience that one way to really interfere with your milk supply is getting pregnant again. So obviously that's something always in the back of my mind, is how do I help this woman not get pregnant so that she can actually breastfeed till a year or 18 months or maybe even 2 years or longer. So, but generally, it's well tolerated, and it should not really, because it's just progesterone, interfere with the milk supply. And again, so little of it gets systemic. And then, I guess the other thing that I should say about the IUDs that is really nice is that because they use progesterone, and Nexplanon as well, but the IUDs specifically use progesterone, which, as we talked about before, is the one where if you take that hormone away, it destabilizes the lining and then you have a period. But also, its whole job is to make the lining thin, as opposed to estrogen that kind of makes the lining thick. And so that's the reason that when you're on some of those types of birth control, it actually can take periods away altogether or make them super light. So generally I tell my patients, 80% of women will have decreased or no periods at all on the Mirena IUD at least. It's less for the Skyla because it's not, the dosages aren't as high and they're not formulated from that. So unless someone is actively trying to get pregnant, which is really the only reason that you need to have periods every month, or unless you just like them, which is fine too. some people do. The IUD are great for young women who don't want, you know, to have to worry about taking a daily pill. They're great for people who have new babies who can't worry about taking a pill. Great for women in their 40s who are starting to have more abnormal bleeding as they get closer to perimenopause, and then even, you know, early 50s if bleeding is kind of getting heavier. We also even sometimes use the IUD to prevent endometrial cancer because it keeps the lining so thin. But in terms of birth control, as an actual like method, like contraception, this illustration is from bedsider.org, and I love it. If you go to their website, you can kind of see different ways. So most effective, they kind of show you here, are the long-acting reversible contraception, abstinence, obviously, and having your tubes tied, hormone-free, which are nice if you're worried about any types of hormones. The copper IUD doesn't have any hormones in it at all, so that gets listed there as well. And then easy to hide, which obviously for a lot of women is being discreet is very important. So my recommended methods, definitely the top left two, because I feel that they, and obviously, you know, abstinence and having your tubes tied are great too if that's appropriate for you in that point of life. But we use the IUD and the Nexplanon all the time just to make bleeding lighter or go away for almost any age woman, even if they are not using it actively for contraception.
Question.
Yeah.
What happens when the eggs are not getting released for a long time? Nothing?
Nothing, really.
They just hang out.
And actually, the method that IUDs work is not to suppress ovulation specifically. There's like five other ways that they work to kind of inhibit. They make the cervical mucus harder for the sperm to penetrate. They decrease the motility of the fallopian tubes. So they work through an abundance of ways. And sometimes it interferes with ovulation, but sometimes it actually doesn't. And so a lot of women who are on a progesterone-containing IUD will still have normal, you know, breast tenderness in the second part of their cycle, and some of the kind of ovulation kind of symptoms. So that being said, sometimes it also will make people get cysts that don't break off. And so anyway, that's actually, it's coming up in a little bit, so I'll talk about that. I'll touch on that again. So briefly, what if you want to get pregnant? Instead of contraception, you know, on the other side of things, because this is a lot of counseling that we do as well. So, what are the four things that you need to get pregnant? Quiz time, I guess.
Sperm.
Yeah.
Egg.
Yep.
Uterus.
Yep.
Uterus.
One other thing.
Progesterone,
yeah. Structurally, there's one other thing. How do the sperm and the egg get together? So you said eggs. You said sperm. Tubes. So the tubes is the other thing. And then uterus, of course, as you got. So, eggs. Obviously, this can be super complicated. If somebody's not having regular periods, we can test their hormones. We can look at FSH, LH, estrogen, progesterone. And then thyroid and other things that maybe wouldn't cause eggs to be released. Obviously, as we talked about before, ovulation predictor kits or those LH surge kits can be really helpful. And by the way, I don't actually know if there's a clock anywhere. Oh, there we go. Perfect. Okay. So ovulation predictor kits, those home LH kits, can kind of help with timing. Age is obviously a factor in terms of eggs. And so as we age, our eggs also age. There's this hormone called AMH, or anti-Müllerian hormone, which is essentially present in the blood at a certain level. And each little teeny tiny egg that's not yet visible on an ultrasound emits some of this AMH, or anti-Müllerian hormone. And so that is one of the tests that we get sometimes to say, to look for ovarian reserve, which is essentially the amount of eggs that a person has left in her body. And every woman is born, as you probably know, every woman is born with as many eggs as she'll ever have. So if the reserve is running low, she might have trouble getting pregnant with her own eggs, or sometimes can even go into early menopause. There are, and then PCOS, as Adam mentioned before, is another one of those syndromes where sometimes people don't ovulate every month. And the other thing about eggs is that their availability, obviously it's complicated, and it can also change every month. So a person could ovulate once or twice and then have a period where they just don't ovulate for 6 months, you know, for whatever reason. So it's not like a constant thing for any one person. There's medications that we can use to help people ovulate or to make people ovulate, especially when there are situations where there are eggs left but they're just not ovulating regularly, to enhance fertility. In terms of sperm, so a third of the time when a couple comes to me with infertility, it can be related to the male factor. And so I usually would recommend doing a sperm sample or a semen analysis if they've been trying for more than a year or more than 6 months in older couples, or if I'm starting to do any kind of testing in a female. And partially that's just because we can do a whole big workup in a female and not find anything, and then last ditch, you know, and it's expensive and harder to test a lot of these things in females, but for males, it's a semen sample, which they don't love doing ever, but, you know, there's a lot of things that we can tell from that. Risk factors for having an abnormal sperm sample would be tobacco, alcohol, drug use, certain infections like mumps. Actually, if you had mumps as a child, and we're having an outbreak in Minnesota last month, or sometimes chlamydia and gonorrhea. And then medical illnesses, tumors, chronic illnesses, sickle cell disease, undescended testicles, surgery, radiation, all sorts of different things that could affect, even, you know, all sorts of things that could affect the sperm to be made normally. Now, the lucky thing, at least in our situation, I think I actually have it on here. So sperm can live for up to 72 hours outside the body, way longer than eggs live outside the ovary. And it takes them about 90 days to turn over completely, and they're constantly regenerating. So what that means is that if you have a male who has had some sort of condition where their sperm has been overheated chronically for some reason, and you're able to correct that, 3 months later you can repeat a sperm sample and it might be totally fine. The things that we would do about this in clinic sometimes to enhance fertility would be we can wash down sperm to kind of get only the best kind of fastest swimmers, and then we put them back right inside the uterus so they don't have to go through the cervix, which there's, you know, this mucus that can kind of slow them down. And then tubes. So obviously we just allow passage of the sperm and eggs so they can meet up, and some risk factors for having tubes blocked would be certain types of sexually transmitted infections, chlamydia, gonorrhea, pelvic inflammatory disease, which is kind of more a disseminated version of chlamydia and gonorrhea, You can have scarring of the tubes from surgery or prior ectopic pregnancy. And then sometimes endometriosis, a ruptured appendix, or pelvic adhesions. Anything that's going to kind of mess around with those little, they're pretty fragile little things. This, you can tell, or this is the x-ray here, which is called a hysterosalpingogram or an HSG test. Basically what we do is we go into the cervix, we put a little catheter full of dye, we shoot dye out, and then we take an x-ray picture as the dye is shooting out the uterus, or out the tubes. So you can see here, on this side, this is the long tube, and it's spilling into the abdomen. This side, the tube is blocked. There's no spillage. So obviously, if you have one blocked tube, you can still have passage of egg into the uterus. If you have two blocked tubes, there's not any other way to get pregnant other than to use in vitro fertilization or IVF. And that's where we actually take eggs, we stimulate the ovary, we take eggs out of the ovary, we take sperm, we combine them together in a petri dish, and then we put them, once it's an actual embryo, then we put it back inside the uterus for pregnancy. And I will bring this up briefly, you know, chlamydia and gonorrhea are both sexually transmitted infections that can be present and infective without having other symptoms. And obviously if they cause scarring, then that's the reason that we care about testing and treating people who are young, because if you haven't had any symptoms, it doesn't mean that you couldn't have an infection. And obviously if you may want children in the future, and in vitro fertilization is expensive. So, and then the fourth thing is the uterus. So pretty relatively rare to be a cause of infertility. And sometimes, you know, a lot of times we'll get an ultrasound, and some things that you would be able to see on a test that we just showed you, the tubal dye test. So you can see here, you can have an abnormally shaped uterus. On the left is a septate uterus, which sometimes you can just take out the septum and then be able to get pregnant. On the very right is a bicornuate, where you actually have kind of two segments. And sometimes women will get pregnant in one horn of a bicornuate uterus. And so you just kind of, you're obviously kind of at risk for preterm delivery in those cases because you don't have quite the same size of a uterus. But and then in the middle is a condition called Asherman syndrome, which is basically scarring inside the uterus, which typically would happen after some kind of a surgery or some other external cause. The septate and bicornuate tend to be things that somebody would be born with. You can still get, and obviously, pregnancy can still occur if you can correct the underlying problems that are going on here. And then finally, other risk factors, large fibroids and polyps, which we'll get to in just a second to talk about that. The definition of infertility is 1 year of unprotected intercourse without any prevention method. So about 20% of couples will get pregnant in the first month, assuming that all the factors are working. So it's actually not a very high number if you think about it. So the chance of actually, and the word is called fecundity, is the chance of getting pregnant in the very first month, very first cycle. So generally when people come in, sometimes they're like, oh yeah, we had sex like for 4 months and we haven't gotten pregnant yet. And I generally tell people, you know, 90% of couples will get pregnant on their own within the first year. And so generally we tend to wait to even worry about it until you get to be a year of trying, because hopefully you're in that 90%. It's just going to take a little bit longer. And obviously you can undergo this kind of extensive workup and do all sorts of things, and still just everything's fine, and you're just on the one side of the continuum versus the other. Although I should mention, you know, if a person is over age 35, then generally we would start the workup after about 6 months rather than waiting, knowing that they just have less time to wait because the eggs start becoming atretic, which is a nice way of saying they die. Okay, and then in the last 5 minutes, we'll just kind of go through some common gynecological conditions. I tried to think of pretty common things, but obviously this list is not exhaustive, so if you think of others, please, you know, bring those questions tonight to the chalet chat, or, you know, raise a hand, or find me throughout the week. Obviously, I'm here till Saturday. So common things, and these last two, not so much conditions, more symptoms. So number one, vaginitis. So anytime you add itis to a word, you're implying an inflammation or an infection or some kind of a process that's going on. So in vaginitis, you can have yeast or bacterial vaginitis, basically an overgrowth that can cause itching, burning, abnormal discharge. Generally, the pH of the of the vagina is low, kind of like the stomach. And so what happens is anything that can make the pH get higher puts you at a risk of getting vaginitis. Because what happens is the pH is low, it kills off other types of bacteria or yeast, you know. If it starts getting higher, then those yeast and bacteria can all of a sudden overgrow, and then you have this kind of overgrowth of yeast or bacteria and a pH problem that kind of just makes itself worse. So risk factors, antibiotics, douching, which is kind of can take away that acid, sex without a condom because semen has a high pH, so sometimes people actually will describe like certain irritation from having sex with their partner, wearing overly tight underwear, or things like, you know, you're going swimming all the time and you don't change right away, or working out and not changing right away. And then some scented soaps or lotions can kind of change the pH of the vagina as well. So generally I tell patients, sleep without underwear on, you know, wear cotton underwear that's breathable, and you don't really need to wash on the inside. Your body takes care of that. Just on the outside is fine. If it's kind of a undetermined what type of vaginitis is it, you could try over-the-counter preparations like Bondistat, which would treat a yeast problem, or hydrocortisone, which is kind of just more for itching, to decrease the inflammation. But of course, and I should also mention, sometimes a lack of estrogen, which can be commonly due to age or menopause, can lead to skin thinning and breakdown, and that's called atrophic vaginitis, which is kind of a whole other realm of why you can have irritation there. But that's best treated with estrogen typically, but whole other talk. And then of course there's also skin conditions, like if you had psoriasis or lichen sclerosis, even skin cancer, which of course those require different types of treatment. So if it's the sort of thing that just hasn't gone away, you might have to see somebody to at least get tested to see if it's a yeast bacteria or if you need a biopsy. Polyps and fibroids. So I said we would talk about these just briefly. Just a couple minutes. So polyps are small areas of skin growth, kind of like a skin tag, which form inside the uterus on the inner lining called the endometrium. Unfortunately, there's not a picture on here. You could have no symptoms, or you could have abnormal periods, or you could have infertility. Treatment for polyps is with a hysteroscopy, meaning looking inside the uterus with a little camera, and then we just take the polyp off. Fibroids are growths of muscle cells in the wall of the uterus. And you'll remember the uterus itself is a muscle, so it's just kind of like an extra little increased area of muscle. Again, you could have no symptoms at all, or sometimes they can cause heavy periods. They can cause people, I mean, they can be very, very large and can cause a lot of pressure in the pelvis. They can make problems with urinating or bowel movements. And then fibroids also can be treated with hysteroscopy, as you can imagine. If you look inside the uterus with a camera, you could take this type of a fibroid away. Or you could go from external, kind of like I showed you that laparoscopy image at the beginning, and take away a fibroid like this. Definitive treatment for fibroids is doing hysterectomy, obviously, but also as people go into menopause, they just kind of shrivel up and don't tend not to cause problems. So even if people had fibroids as a young person, if they never needed any treatment, then there's nothing, generally they're so benign that we don't worry about it enough to really do anything about them if we do know that they're there. Endometriosis is a condition where the lining of the uterus is outside the uterus. So basically then when that lining is stimulated by hormones, it can cause inflammation where it's implanted because it's kind of trying to slough off like in a period, but that can lead to a lot of pain. The lining of the abdominal wall is very sensitive to pain. So like when people come in with an appendicitis, it's just a little inflamed appendix. It's a teeny little thing. It can cause severe pain. Endometriosis is the same way. So pain from endometriosis can be treated with medications, NSAIDs like ibuprofen, sometimes you use birth control like to stop periods so that they don't have the hormone cycling. Or there's a shot which works on GnRH, that gonadotropin-releasing hormone, at the level of the brain to actually stop ovulation, and essentially is a shot to put you in menopause for 3 months at a time, which is obviously kind of a drastic measure for a young woman. And then sometimes we do surgery to burn off endometriosis or to cut it out. Definitive treatment is removal of the uterus and the ovaries, but obviously taking out the ovaries puts a person into menopause, so we take that really seriously to do that. But it's similar to fibroids in that usually once the person kind of goes through menopause, the ovaries aren't acting on that lining anymore, and the pain should go away. So ovarian cysts, it's kind of a catch-all term for a lot of different things. There's so many different kinds of ovarian cysts, and most are just these kind of benign cysts. But so you can have cysts filled with endometriosis, like we just talked about. Functional cysts, which you might remember here from that, remember it can be up to 2 centimeters sometimes in just a normal person who's ovulating all the time. You have the cyst that's kind of left over in the ovary. When the egg has broken off the side, that's totally normal. You can have ruptured hemorrhagic cysts, which is essentially where the egg has broken off the side. If it breaks through a part of the ovary that has a very small capillary, you can have bleeding back into that cyst. And sometimes people have a lot of pain from that because, again, it's blood in the belly, and that can be irritating. And then you can have dermoid cysts, which are fascinating, and they, because it's the ovary, they can differentiate into multiple different organs in the body, like teeth, hair, sebum. They're not super common. Usually we would find them in ultrasound. Most of the time we take them out. Not always. You don't have to. And then cancerous cysts, of course, really rare, most are benign, but in a postmenopausal woman or in a cyst with any abnormal appearance on ultrasound, it really should be checked out by somebody who looks at ultrasounds, by a gynecologist, to decide, can we watch this? Should it come out? Obviously, we never want to miss ovarian cancer or anything like that. Ectopic pregnancy, I am over time, so I just want to tell you, oh, hemorrhaging, that would have been a good one too. Hemorrhaging, okay. So we can talk about those things later, or if people want to stick around for a couple more minutes, I can go back. But I wanted to thank you all for coming and also say this is a photo taken, this is a little bit of nepotism talking, but this is taken by Matthew's dad. He's an awesome photographer. He has a bunch of Holden at night pictures. If you want to buy them, they're for sale in the Holden store on little note cards. It would be an awesome thing to bring home to other people, or you could store them away and send them to your friends that you met at Holden. Does anyone have questions now? Should I go back? And yeah, Julie.
I'm wondering if they're any closer to developing a test for endometriosis versus having to have laparoscopy to find it?
Not that I've heard of. So generally, endometriosis is a really tricky thing because obviously the only way, the definitive way to diagnose it would be to do surgery, to take out a section, to look at that biopsy segment under a microscope and then say, yep, that's endometrial cells in the wrong spot, so you have endometriosis. Sometimes the pain of endometriosis can be really similar to a condition that we call just dysmenorrhea, meaning painful periods, kind of like Elaine was saying before, you know, what causes that crampy pain. It's generally like a lower abdominal pain that's worse with periods and that kind of thing. A lot of times they're pretty similar, so we tend to treat them the same. And that means we start with medications for the pain. Like I said before, sometimes we suppress periods, sometimes we even give a shot to put somebody into menopause to see if that makes their pain better. We don't have any really good way of even, we don't even do like needle biopsies for it or anything. I know some people will check like a CRP or other, like sed rate or other kind of inflammatory markers, but unfortunately they're just so non-specific, I think it's pretty hard. And so, yeah, generally, patients come in kind of begging for surgery. And once they've got to that point of like, I've tried everything, I need it burned out, I need it cut out, I need to know what's going on, you know. So sometimes we'll just try them on that, the menopause shot, and then we kind of have a good answer. But unfortunately, there's not a good cure for it. And no, there's not, that I'm aware of, any like upcoming test, like a blood test to be able to know. Any other questions? Anyway, I know we're like already beyond our time, so thank you for
both. Male birth control. Are there any new forms of male birth control?
I have heard that there may be forms of male birth control, but nothing that I've actually heard of like in wide use on the market. I'm not a urologist, so there might be other things in the male literature that I'm just not aware of, but mastectomy is kind of the best way, but but yeah, definitely, I mean, they theoretically should work generally the same. We use GnRH agonists in kind of like in women who we would want to be ovulating more. We use those same medications in men to get sperm to be healthier and in higher number, so I would have to believe that they would be able to manipulate sperm to be lower, but I don't know specifically. Vasectomy is the only type that I know about. Any other questions? Or otherwise, everyone's welcome. At 8:30, we're going to be in the bottom floor of Shelley 2. Or is there a question here?
No.
We'll be in the bottom floor of Shelley 2. And basically, that's just kind of a forum for if you want to come and ask more anonymous questions, we'll just kind of open the floor. And I know there's a lot of other health experts in the room here, so we can maybe make it a little more round robin. Our L&D nurse or our family practice people or emergency room or pharmacy wants to jump in. Maybe there's other questions that would be even better answered. But yeah, feel free to come to that at 8:30. And then I'm also doing and maybe I'll do the last couple of slides at my second presentation on Thursday afternoon, but then that will be more focused on, we talk a little bit about ovarian aging and then a lot about menopause and Women's Health Initiative study and hormone therapy and those types of things. So thank you again for coming on such a lovely afternoon, and maybe we'll see you tonight or on Thursday or just around. So thanks again.